So the title for this talk today, I think I would call it the anatomy of a koan. What it is and what it isn't. I think that originally the koans, as I have read and come to understand, were just dialogues between a master and the teacher's students, or between students, or between masters to teachers, but fundamentally they were dialogues that, because of their relevance and teaching points, were treasured and carried through centuries of Zen practice. As time went on, these conversations became distilled and shortened, honed into their critical finest points. And then I think there was a somewhat of a shift in the way these koans were experienced, and they became more of a testing device, so that an old dialogue, an old koan, would be brought up by the teacher and given to the student to test their awakening, to test their clarity, to test their presence of mind. And this is still happening today. However, in our Korean lineage of Zen, there is another emphasis, and that is not so much on a test, but experiencing first and foremost a before-thinking mind. You're presented with an event, a dialogue, something happening. And it's an exercise in facing this new phenomenon without prejudgment, without fear, without without anything, with an open mind. And then from that place, discerning what is real here and what is not real. What is true and what is, a fantasy? And also, what's important and what's not important? All of this in the briefest, of time, less than a second. There's something that our intuition and intelligence both need to assess and show up for when we meet this dialogue. I thought I would give you an example from a very recent experience. I was at a American Zen Teachers Association convention last week, and this is for there were about 35 of us gathered together from all different traditions. Some of the old guard, people my age and even older, and then a younger set of teachers, all mixed together. And as you can imagine, like any collection of people, doesn't matter what their titles are or what their experience is, it can get a little contentious. Every time we have one of these meetings, someone among us gives a Dharma talk for everyone else. So a Dharma talk was given, and it was a lovely talk about life and death, and poetry of Basho was brought out. And there were some wonderful analogies brought forward about death and also the death of self, and creating the wider being that has no life, no death. It was a very nice talk. At the end of the talk, there was time for question and answer, just like we do it here. And perhaps the oldest and most senior among us had a question. You know, he raised his hand. And I could feel the room kind of going a little tense because this is someone who is who likes to be challenging and is steeped in this Kung'an tradition. And so he presented this question. He said, "When politics kills all human beings, what will come next?" The speaker, the one giving the Dharma talk, turned a little red, couldn't think of what to say. Needless to say, he was of the younger generation, and this the one who asked the question is of the older generation and can be a bit intimidating. We all understood that, but nevertheless, things went very silent. And the conversation ended there. The dialogue ended there. So from where I was sitting, you know, it goes off in my head, oh, Kung'an, a tactile Kung'an. And this is a, you know, a Kung'an, a question that is designed to test, to provoke. So the first order of business in this in when meeting this style of question, calling for a response, is to discern where the energy is coming from. Because our emotions and you know, our thinking can get so far in front of any clear free engagement, we're often left like this speaker, you know, kind of fumbling. The aggression is felt, and we don't know what to do. We don't know how to reply. So the first order of business, same as with our seated meditation, is to stop, let everything go. Rest in openness. Tap into this before thinking mind, however briefly. And then meet that question. Like two, we say in Zen language, like two arrow points meeting. So meeting what is facing us involves our being able to see clearly, to hear clearly, to discern clearly. And there's a meticulousness to this perception. In that room, conceivably, when the old teacher asked, when politics kills all human beings, what will come next? A truthful answer might be the wall is white and the floor is brown. I mean, that's something that's true in the moment. But as you can feel, I'm sure this does nowhere, this is in no way meets that moment head on. It's a way of saying something that's true, but avoiding the essential point. So what to do? How to meet this? How would you respond? Maybe later in our question and answer period, we can toss that around. But I think it takes some courage and clarity. It's not tied up with opinions. I mean, in this Sangha, they talk quite freely about opinions about politics. And, you know, names are named and they really get into it. The host Sangha for this meeting. But how can we respond in a way that doesn't attach to opinions about one, politics? What can we watch out for in this question that is maybe not true? There are several things, several things. There is this preloaded condition when politics kills all human beings. Are we going to automatically swallow that? Are we going to automatically just take that on as a condition? Do we need to? Sometimes when we're responding to a challenging question, in our desire to be with someone, we have to be careful that we are not losing our center and not losing our own direct experience of truth. We don't know that that's going to happen, and it's an assumption. It carries an assumption about politics. It carries an ex assumption about extinction of the human race. Indeed, we may become extinct sometime down the road, and cockroaches and crows will have their day in the sun, living it up without us, neither here nor there. And then there's this other thing that's heaped on top of that, this beginning phrase. What will come next? So, on top of something that we don't know, we're asked to predict something in the future, which we don't know. And then, what will happen in that non-knowable future? So, this is, in a way, a kind of classic con. How can we cut through all these layers of assumption and dramatic presentation? One order of business, in addition to being clear and to meet a situation point on, is to consider function. What is the fitting function of this reply? In this instance, when this teacher, the older teacher, was asking the question, there was a palpable sense of challenge and aggression. But here's something, and so that would have a certain quality to a reply that, to meet that in a functional, clear, and compassionate way. But here's what happened next in that 4 days of conferencing. Couple days later, there was a breakout group discussing some topic. I don't even remember which one. And present in this smaller group of teachers was this, again, this older teacher who likes to challenge students and other teachers. And he was giving a presentation. And there was another teacher, not quite as old, not quite as experienced, who decided, I could tell that there was a personality conflict, a difference of philosophy and teaching between these two. So the older teacher was giving his presentation, and periodically this younger teacher would interrupt and ask some kind of question that was meant to be a kind of barb. And this went on several times, the interruption, the barb, and the old teacher trying to get back to his presentation. And finally the old teacher said, you can poke at me. You can even hit me with a sledgehammer. I don't mind. I just want to present the Dharma. But I could tell that he was hurt, that he was feeling battered. And even though he said, "You can hit me with a sledgehammer," it was hurting the guy. And then suddenly he brought up this question again. He said, "When politics kills all human beings, what will come next?" But this time he was like near tears. And he was incredibly sincere. I could feel that this is a question that was very personal. And in some ways it got framed in this way, but it was a real question for him. I thought, okay, not a Kungan, I'm not a Dharma combat style Hung on now. Same question, but a different question entirely. In other words, one to which another kind of response would be more fitting, more true. And so I leaned over to him and I said, "Just by the fact that you're asking this question now, already all beings have been saved." It's like the whole room kind of relaxed a little bit. The tension had been building up. And then this older teacher and we talked about just life and death, and in just a more warm-hearted way. So this is, these koans, they are always present between us. Often, a koan, as it's understood in popular literature, it's meant to be some impenetrable, non-logical puzzle. But really, this is our human, a koan is a dialogue where we are challenged to be real, to be authentic, to see what's real and what's authentic. And find our fitting function in the living, breathing, discursive, problematic life that we live. It's one thing to be clear when we're sitting in meditation, but as we all know, what's it for? It's for how we live in the world, it's for how we treat each other and listen to each other. And resolve differences. So, this testing that it, the Kangan practice evolved into, in some ways, it's still very much a kind of testing, but without the grade point averages and the pass fail options. It's a way that we can test ourselves. And we can try this in a moment that feels somewhat uncomfortable in a conversation with family or friends or co-workers. Can we step back, pause for openness without jumping into something reactive? We can test ourselves in this way. Can we see what's clear and what's true and what's not clear and what's not true? Go for what's true. Meet that person there, right there, in some way that's fitting and helpful. Essentially, Kungan training is a kind of yoga. I would go so far as to say it's a kind of yoga, a whole body expression of being in the moment, relaxed, attentive, and responsive. When a question is raised as a koan, or in daily life, in which it presents as a koan, let's not sort of attracted to something that might be clever. It's not about being clever. It's not about being particularly smart at all. But it has a quality of inquiry and developing a don't know mind, which is essentially a ready mind. That is something that takes years and dedication to develop. I wanted to bring up a story as a one that's familiar to many of you, but I think it's so lovely it's worth repeating. And this is taken from Dropping Ashes on the Buddha, the book by our founding teacher Zen Master Sung San. It's about a monk named Sudok, Soktu, which literally translates to mean rockhead. According to the story, he was too stupid to understand the scriptures or to do koan work for that matter, and he had trouble even doing seated meditation, but he was determined to understand Buddhism. So one day he went to the master and asked, "What is Buddha?" The master replied, "Buddha is mind." The word in Korean sounded something like this, "Juksim Shibo." But Soktu misheard, thinking he said, "Buddha is grass shoes," which in Korean sounds something like this, "Jipshin Shibo." Baffled by this apparently very difficult koan, Soktu worked on it for a very long time, struggling to understand. Then one day, he tripped over a rock. One of his grass shoes flew off and broke upon hitting the ground. Soktu experienced a profound awakening. "Buddha is grass shoes," he exclaimed. He ran to the master and said he understood. Asked to bring his understanding, he whacked the master on the head with his broken grass shoe. The master then asked, "Is that all?" And Soktu replied, "All my grass shoes are broken." The master laughed. "Wonderful," he said. "Now you truly understand Buddha." So this case, I think, is wonderful to bring up for the sense that we often have in our lives, in our koan training, that we need to get it right. We need to get the right answer. But this is a practice of waking up, let's not forget. This is a practice of becoming clear. So even mishearing a word, mishearing a teaching, if it provokes this deep inquiry into truth, then still awakening will happen. Understanding, true understanding will arise. So it's in that spirit of complete dedication and complete try mind that we engage in our meditation, in our koan work, and in our daily lives. It's koan training is a safe experimental way in which we can try out how to live an authentic life. Certainly, we're not going to get it right a lot of the time. But if we have that energy and compassionate dedication that Soktu demonstrated in this story, then we can get the important things right, which is our heart, our body, our mind aligned with present moment reality so that we can help all beings.